The Honorable Rockhold presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is May 8, 2025. We are sitting in the St. Louis County Courthouse in Duluth, and many thanks to the staff here that have made it possible for us to appear in this location. And I see the attorneys are here and present. I will make a few remarks, but ask the marshal to call the first case.
We will go on the record in the matter of In Re, the Trust of Thomas Karakash Family Trust and the Ann Karakash Family Trust, court file number A241421.
Again, welcome to the court. I want to make a couple quick remarks. First of all, just to let everyone know, we have two matters on our oral argument calendar today. The first matter has been called. When you approach the podium, if you would remember a few things, I would appreciate it. First of all, please identify yourself as well as the client you represent. Please keep your eye on the clock. It should be visible to you. It's visible to us over here. If you remember, we do enjoy our conversations today. It's our opportunity to hear from you and to engage in a conversation about the case. But the time tends to go quickly, and so we just ask you to keep an eye on the clock. And then the last thing that I'd ask you to do is keep in mind that today's proceedings are recorded. First of all, they are made available via Zoom, so video conference presently, but also we maintain an audio recording of today's proceedings, and that is later available on the court's website. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed, and counsel for appellant, you can come forward and begin your argument. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Steve Siddick. I represent the appellant, Peter Karakash, in this matter. I just read a poll from Gallup in 2024 of American citizens that said that the U.S. has seen the steepest decline in the faith of the judiciary system in the last 20 years. I think there's people on our side of the V that would think that this case that we're here to talk about today, people would probably say that on our side of the V that they would agree with that decline. What we have here, Your Honors, is a abuse of discretion on the three issues we're here to talk about. That is the decision to deny the motion for a new trial, the decision to impose sanctions on Peter Karakash, and the court's refusal to disqualify itself in this case. With respect to the first issue of the new trial, the court abused its discretion because, as I said in my brief, almost none of the court's findings and conclusions were supported by the evidence at trial.
Well, counsel, if you don't mind, I don't want to interrupt your stream of concentration too much, but I just want to understand, first of all, why you're asking for a new trial. So you didn't ask for amended findings, but your brief makes a lot of suggestion that you have in fact proven your case, but the judge didn't make the findings that it should have made based on the evidence, so that the findings themselves were erroneous. So do you need a new trial with more evidence, or is it that the district court can make the correct decision if it followed your thinking, I guess.
I suppose it could make those findings. I think I question whether or not, I mean, technically I think it could. I question whether the judge would do that. I mean, we did make a motion for amended findings, and those were rejected. We made a motion for a new trial.
I mean, you're an experienced trial lawyer, you know how this goes. I mean, you don't usually get a new trial unless there's some procedural error or some, piece of evidence. And I know there is this argument about financial documents. So I was wondering, is that your claim? Is that you still don't have the financial documents you need to prove your case?
Well, I mean, that's part of it. I think we proved our case in the underlying at trial. And I think the judge ignored the evidence that we presented or mischaracterized the evidence and mischaracterized our position that from which we brought the case in the first place. And that's evident in the
court. And as I understand it, you stipulated to the exhibits.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
So it wasn't a fight over the exhibits.
There was no fight over any of the exhibits. Those were all admitted, Your Honor. And if you look back at the court's findings of fact, I mean, we start off with the court, you know, talking about how I'm using first names because there's many Karakash people involved. It means no disrespect, of course. All of the court's findings and conclusions were based on this claim that Peter was pursuing this claim as trustee. The trial judge did not even acknowledge the law, the rights of a beneficiary and how Peter was pursuing this claim as a beneficiary. Thankfully, Dale Wolf, the judge who denied the motion to dismiss the initial claim, did recognize that and said, no, Peter Karakash has a right to pursue this claim based on his status as beneficiary. The trustees owe him fiduciary duties, and he has a right to pursue this claim. And that's what we did. And
I do track your argument about this claim being won by a beneficiary and that there are very specific duties owed. I guess I want to just go quickly back to my question about, are you asking for additional financial documents as one of the reasons why you need a new trial?
I think, yes, we are, Your Honor. I think that's one of the reasons, and I think we need a new trial. I think we need it before an impartial judge, because I think there are issues. That's the third issue.
Well, what if we disagree with you about that? We don't think this judge should have disqualified, in this case, himself.
I don't know. I think
you still want a new trial?
I think that, sorry, can you ask that again, Your Honor?
If we disagree with you on the third issue.
Yes.
All right. Do you still want a new trial?
For a different judge.
What? What would be the rationale that we disagree with you on disqualification?
Based on what happened at the trial court with the judge's findings, the sanction order, I don't think my client can get a fair trial in front of the trial court judge that had heard this case. Simply can't. The level of hostility towards Peter and the judge's orders, I haven't seen anything like that. It's completely unwarranted. There is literally nothing in the evidence supporting the judge's findings of sanction and his hostility. And all I'm saying with respect to point three is, Judge, all we wanted to know at the beginning of the case, all we wanted was a chance to decide whether or not and inquire further whether there was something about a relationship between the court and counsel and the court's wife. If there was something, I wanted to know, my client should have had the right to know or to at least ask questions about that. And never were.
Okay. So my question, there are so many different roles that are at play here. There's co-trustee, beneficiary, corporate officer. And I've asked both of you how those overlap or don't overlap the duties that are owed. And
sure.
And with regard to that, the financial documents that may be okay to give to a co-trustee, but beneficiary is different. Can you articulate that?
I can. It is an interesting arrangement, but the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, it means nothing that Peter Karakash was not a member of an officer of the corporation running the corporation. That has nothing to do with his ability to access information in this capacity as beneficiary. The Otto Bremer case, which this court is very familiar with, the Supreme Court case agreed with you. It's very simple. A trustee must disclose fully and frankly, without reservation, all facts pertaining to a trust to beneficiaries.
So here's what I've struggled with, and maybe you can help me, is if, you know, this trust is designed a little differently than the Otto Bremer Trust, right? In the Otto Bremer Trust, there's money and that money's getting distributed.
Right.
Here what's held is the S Corp. And I wasn't able to locate any Minnesota law that says when what's held are shares in a corporation. What, like, how does the duty of information work when what's held are shares? And so I would, one, if you have any Minnesota case law that would point me to, you know, what's the scope of that? And if not, you know, of any outside jurisdictions that have sort of handled this nuance, I think that you would admit there is in this case with regard to the trust actually holds the.
If there was, I would have hopefully found it and told you about it and told the judge about this years ago, but there isn't. And I think that because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that the trust holds an S Corp. The trust holds, the resort is what the S Corp, that's the reason for the S Corp, is to run the resort. The resort is the only asset of the trust. Okay. That's the purpose.
And it's the property and the shares of the S Corp or just the S Corp? I want to know what is exactly the property that's held in the trust.
It's the resort. The shares of the S Corp are pieces of paper. They don't mean they don't mean anything. It's a share that's owned. The shares are owned by the trust. The shares, you can sell a share, but what goes with the share of the resort? The resort goes with it. So it's the John Karakash's duty and Teresa Felmley's duties as co-trustees, whether you call them, they're co-trustees, they're managers of the corporation, it's their job to run the trust and make it as profitable as possible for the benefit of the beneficiaries. That's the whole point of our claim. It doesn't matter whether you get, whether they're acting as corporate officers, they're still trustees that owe a duty to the beneficiaries.
So do you think a beneficiary is owed more financial information than a co-trustee?
Well, a co-trustee can keep whatever information they want because they're the co-trustee, right? But I think as a beneficiary under that fact, and I understand that the trust is different and not a Bremer, but it doesn't matter because a trustee has that fiduciary duty. It's a breach of fiduciary duty, this court held, for a trustee not to disclose full and complete facts without reservation to a beneficiary about the trust. And that's what happened here. It happened for years. It didn't. We were weeks before trial and we got 1,000 pages of the documents that supported our exhibit. So all these findings from the judge saying he had all this information, he knew this stuff was going to be false. He made these claims knowing this stuff didn't support his claim. It's completely false. It's just not true. It's not in the factual record. It's not accurate.
So what are the full facts? I mean, just give me an example of facts that you were not allowed to learn about. I understand the lateness of the disclosure, but
sure.
Because I just didn't see that, sure, in your brief, counsel, so I'm just trying to understand.
Sure. So one of the things, I guess we finally did get the final tax returns from 2023, I believe, after litigation was over. The main thing, Judge, is an accounting of the trust assets. You know what an accounting is. There's never been one provided to date. The Ryan Jarvie from the accounting firm said no trust accounting had ever been provided. The trial judge said, oh, you were given an accounting because you were given bank records and tax returns. That's not an accounting.
And as I understand it, there wasn't a separate account for the trust.
No, there wasn't. There was no separate account for the trust, Judge, and that's a huge problem. That's what we showed. I mean, you know what the rule is from Otto Bremer, and that's there's no such thing as a de minimis violation of the duty of self-dealing. And we've had admissions of those at trial, and there was none, just completely glossed over by the trial court, not even referenced at all.
On a more practical matter, as I read the trust in 2027, 10 years after the father's death, the lodge is to be sold?
That's right.
And so if your client were to win everything he wants and thinks he's legally entitled to, what would that be?
It would be money would be reimbursed to the back into the resort and used for, you know, increasing the resort's value, whether it's through expansion, marketing, and whatever the co-trustees and managers decides in the best interest of the resort for the benefit of all the beneficiaries who are the two co-trustees and my client. That's what he wanted from the very beginning.
Isn't there a way that you can bring in action for a judicial accounting of a trust? And did you bring that type of claim?
Yes, that was our claim. We demanded.
And so the remedy that you're seeking is an accounting, yeah, after the trial.
Okay. Right. And that's never been done.
And I guess I ask because there's a lot of dispute about the trustees have never done an accounting, your client, no one's ever done an accounting for the purpose of the trial. And there's a lot of going back about that in your briefing. And so I just wanted to clarify that part of what the remedy is that you were seeking is not that either party would do an accounting as part of this trial, but that you had put forth enough evidence that a judicial accounting should occur. I guess that's.
Well, it wasn't that we wanted the judge to make an accounting. We wanted the trustees to fulfill their fiduciary obligation to do an accounting.
But the judge can order an accounting.
Sure.
And so I guess I just want to clarify this dispute between you and respondent with regard to what was required at trial, because it seems, right, to me that when you bring a claim that what you want is an accounting, nobody needs to come to trial with an accounting.
No. When you make a demand for accounting, the result should be somebody should do one, right? That was our claim. We had never seen an accounting. None had ever been done. We asked for one, and the judge said, you've got enough information, do it yourself. That's what the judge said to Peter. You've got the information, you can do it yourself. That turns trust law completely upside down on its head. The beneficiary now has an obligation to do it, an accounting of how a trust is operated by co-trustees. I've never heard that anywhere. That's not the law. And that's what happened here. The judge said, Peter had sufficient information. If he wanted accounting, he could hire someone to do it himself. Now it's Peter's individual responsibility to do it. The trustees should have done in the first place. So the closest thing that happened in accounting was when Peter finally got access to these documents, was able to put together a spreadsheet showing how the trust, how the company on behalf of the trust was spending the trust assets. It's still not complete.
I'm looking at your petition, looking at the wherefore clauses.
Yeah, that's, I haven't done that well. It was, yeah. Does it, yeah, it should, I think it does request an accounting. If it doesn't, yeah. So, yeah, that was sort of the biggest problem. And there was a fight all the way through trial, all the way through just the discovery process, the pretrial. And we were basically told that no information would be produced, no financial information would be produced without a court order. So we had to go back to the judge. I mean, we went back to the judge with informal discovery conferences four times, saying, "Judge, we had to subpoena documents from the trust."
I'm very sympathetic to the frustration that you experienced and your clients, you know, in terms of repeated motions to compel and just visits to get these documents. But I guess I'm still a little stuck on what additional specific financial documents you didn't get that you're entitled to. To me, an accounting is separate. That we already talked about that. I mean, that does depend on a wholesome disclosure. You can't do an accounting correctly without it. But I guess what I, you know, for all of the complaints that you made about the discovery given by respondents in this case, it seems as though you built a case. I'm like, well, do you need more records?
I'm just pressed
because if we agree with you in remand, we have to consider what the scope of the remand is. Right. And so that's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah. And I think, there may be additional information that wasn't the focus of our position at trial, was that we still need more information. It was that the claim was that we cooperated with you and done everything you wanted and given everything you wanted. We didn't breach any duties because we've given you everything. And that's just not what the evidence is at trial. I mean, I've cited right in my brief, I can tell you, but,
But I do think that because this was a bench, may I ask?
Okay, go ahead.
Please. I do believe that because this was a bench trial, right, Rule 59.01 applies a little bit differently. And I do think that it's possible that instead of reopening the trial, that the district court just could be required to do some amended findings of fact or to make new findings under Rule 59.01. Is that the relief that you're asking for? Or do you really, want a whole new trial?
I want a new trial before a new judge. Going back to the amended findings before the trial court judge, based on what happened in the trial court's findings and in the sanctions order, a one-page ruling on a motion for a new trial, I mean, I don't think my client can get a fair resolution with this trial judge in place.
Of course, counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll just say, from my standpoint, if you would give some consideration to the lack of case law suggesting in Minnesota none that a Facebook relationship could qualify a judge, and the ABA guidance on that doesn't suggest it would either. I don't want you to answer that question now. All right, we've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. We can talk about that premise that you have that you, if you get a new trial, it would be in front of a new judge. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And counsel for respondent, we're ready for you. Thank you.
Thank you, honors. My name is Kelly Poon. I represent John Karakash in this matter. I think the court's questions of the appellate are valid, and I'd like to give a little explanation, at least from the perspective of the respondent. So, yes, my understanding, or the understanding through trial and through this case, has been that the trust itself does not have a bank account. It has performed yearly tax returns. Those tax returns are derived from the profit and loss of the S-Corp. The S-Corp itself does have a bank account, and it also holds the land. There was a question about how the land is held. How is the actual resort held? It's held in the S-Corp. The trust basically allowed John Karakash to run the S-Corp. The S-Corp has had ongoing and consistent accountings. So the S-Corp has done annual tax returns. They have revenue receipts, they have expenses, and then they have final profit and loss. That's been done by a third party, Ryan Jarvie, who testified at trial.
But the way I understand Mr. Jarvie's testimony is that he's determining whether things that were occurring are compliant with the IRS and taxes. He's not assessing whether or not the fiduciary duties to appellant have been. I mean, right. I mean, there's a different level of expertise and there's a different standard that it seems to me that he's been applying with regard to the tax returns that it doesn't directly correlate. I don't think you would disagree with me that that doesn't directly correlate to the law regarding what's required to preserve trust, as opposed to what are things that you can not pay taxes on.
Sure. Yes, I would agree that he is an accountant, a CPA by nature. He is there just to vet the accounts in terms of the tax returns and help produce a tax return. He was brought by the respondents in an effort to show their ongoing efforts to manage and to run a successful business and company.
But I think that you rely on his testimony pretty heavily to say that there have been no breaches of fiduciary duties, and I'm just not sure that that's the assessment that he's been doing in those accountings, as opposed to making sure that the business is running compliant with the law outside of what the law is with regard to the trust.
Sure, Your Honor. Yes, in a way. I mean, it's just to, again, substantiate the accountings as they are today. I also testified with John Karakash and his wife, Sean Karakash, who is also the treasurer of the corporation. Can I just talk about data and information? Yes, we did have a number of discovery conference, a number of conferences before the judge relative to data. So in the end, all ledgers, so the QuickBook ledger was provided.
But I don't really think that that's the argument. I think the argument is that the appellant should not have had to go to litigation to get access to that information because he's a beneficiary. He should have been able to request that of the trustees, and the trustee should have provided that information. And the very fact that he had to go to litigation to get that information means that there's a violation of the duty of information.
So
I think that's the argument.
I think that is the argument, but you know, this has been previously litigated, Your Honor, in a number of different cases.
I mean, I think that in our recent Warren case out of the Court of Appeals, we were pretty clear that beneficiaries hold a different position than co-trustees. I think in that case, there was a co-trustee who had one of her claims thrown out because she brought it in the name of the beneficiary instead of bringing it in the name of the co-trustee. And so I think that it's not quite precise to say that we've already litigated this when I think everyone admits that appellant brought those claims in a different role than he brought them in this case.
Yes, I just, the only caveat I would say is when I say we already litigated is that we're following the previous orders relative to the provision of the tax.
Relative to
co-trustee, not beneficiary.
And I understand, Aaron. I understand what.
Which is why Judge Wolf said this is a different case and didn't dismiss it. And I want to get to the second argument, the sanctions.
Yes.
I think Usselman must control this case.
It's
the case of Usselman,
yes,
or however you pronounce
yes.
it, where there wasn't, the Rule 12 was denied, and therefore you couldn't have sanctions at the end of the case for continuing to litigate it. And then secondly, I didn't find anywhere in the record where a district court judge told Peter to stop. I mean, you in your brief say he was warned repeatedly not to pursue this. I couldn't find anywhere in the record. And when I read your brief, what you cited to was MnSTAT 549.211, where the attorney certified that it wasn't a frivolous claim. But I didn't see anywhere else where Peter was warned. And can you point me to any record evidence that the judge said, stop this, it's frivolous?
No, Your Honor, I don't think there was a specific point to stop this, it's frivolous.
Well, I mean, we look at the record.
Yes.
For
yes.
record support. And so I'm asking you if there's record support for the sanctions award.
Your Honor, throughout the sanctions, throughout the court's findings on the sanctions, really the respondent took no position on this, to be honest with you. You know, we let the court drive this.
Well, then there has to be record testimony to support the findings that mm-hmm. sanctions were warranted.
So,
and so if you took no position, then you can't point us to any record
Your Honor, during these informal discovery conferences or these motions, these informal motions to compel, you know, the judge warned, from my perspective, both parties, you know, comply.
There's a transcript, right?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
And, you know, counsel, I appreciate that you might feel like you're in a tight spot on the sanctions since you didn't move for sanctions. I mean, that is an important thing to note from your perspective. And it does cause us to examine the district court's basis for awarding sanctions. But, you know, to point back to the discovery issues that occurred between the parties, first of all, it's not unusual for parties to struggle over discovery. But as was mentioned by, you know, in the question that Judge Larson asked, I mean, that's kind of the premise of this case is with Peter's status as beneficiary, shouldn't have to go to litigation or move to compel to get full information about this trust. I mean, I understand that's Minnesota law. So can you help me understand why we would affirm the district court's analysis, given that you're essentially conceding that there was this struggle to get information?
Yep. You know, my best response to this is, yes, the trustees had a duty to keep the beneficiaries reasonably informed. The S-Corp tax returns of the financials under Minnesota Statute 302A, 461, 302A, 463, 501C, 0.0813 requires these financials be given.
To the shareholders, right? I mean, that's a shareholder and statute. That's not a beneficiary. That's not about trusts. That's about corporate shareholders. I just want to make sure that I'm referencing the right statute.
As to a shareholder, correct. Yes, that is true. As to a shareholder.
Question I guess I'd like to ask, since you've got some time, is, you know, and I think I understand, I mean, I see it in the district court's findings of fact, the recognition that Peter's also made a claim that he has been excluded physically from the property, right, from use of the property. And it appears as though that was undisputed by the respondents in their own testimony. So that is a claim that I see recognized in the district court's findings of fact. I see it actually undisputed in terms of the record. And yet there's no finding by the district court. And that was an explicit request for relief by the petitioner. So it seems to me, and it says on the exclusion issue, that the district court's work is not even done yet. I mean, there was no conclusion. Am I missing something there that in the record? I mean, it's, you know this better than I do.
The court did not make an affirmative record on it.
And you agree with the way I mean, it was very quick, but my description of the testimony?
At testimony, there's a lot of information, a lot of evidence here, so just characterized. My understanding of it was that, yes, access was cut off during this litigation because they could not get along, and that they would revisit the access and work together on providing access. You know, this
what
is family.
What do you have under our trustee law that it doesn't violate the duty of impartiality to exclude one member of the trust from the property but allow the other beneficiaries to have access to property?
I think they recognize that Peter needs access to the property. And I think that was, unfortunately, there was not a finding on it precisely, but I think that is well established and understood, at least from my side, relative to Peter.
So now I'm going to ask an extra record question after asking you about that. It just seems like this case should be mediated probably by a family law mediator. Has there been any attempt to mediate?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. I'm sure that
we were unsuccessful.
Quite sad.
Yeah.
About what's going on.
Yeah. You know, in the county, Your Honor, I guess, what does that mean in this case? I grapple with that issue too. I'm actually fundamentally, if you provide the receipts, you provide the revenue numbers coming in, you provide the QuickBooks accounting, you know, those are the building blocks of then creating a profit and loss for the business. That was the accounting. What I'm struggling with is all that was provided. I think the court asked this question, what new information? So from that accounting, from the information that we provided, There was a exhibit, a Rule 1006 exhibit, which was a summary exhibit, and it outlined all the items that were contested within the accounts. Things that the appellant felt were of self-dealing, things that they felt were wrong. We answered each of those. And
well,
the court made
is that fair to say that you really answered each of those? I mean, I think that there are, you have the testimony from Mr. Jarvie saying that some of those are ordinary business expenses, but that doesn't really answer the self-dealing.
My client testified.
It answers the tax issue, as we've already talked about, not the fiduciary duties that we're talking about. And isn't that what inequitable accounting would do? It would really analyze that and say, is it appropriate for trustees to essentially do things like travel and have that paid for by the S Corp when in fact those dollars could have been returned to the trust and used?
I understand your question. My client was on the stand. He was examined by myself on every single one of those items as well as counsel. He answered relative to his actions relative to each of those items. That is the best that I don't know another way for him to answer on those.
And I guess our concern is that the district court in siding with you at the end of the day, the district court was applying the wrong standard. It was doing things like saying, is this allowed under the tax laws? I mean, that's what Mr. Jarvie testified to, and the district court accepted that as fulfilling fiduciary duties. And, you know, those two things, unless you can persuade me otherwise, they aren't the same under the law.
Your Honor, I think that it is for the, if you remand it back to the district court and they make additional findings, that's for the judge to make as to whether or not those standards were met. I think he implicitly meant for them to be met. Perhaps he didn't specifically say no self-dealing. He didn't specifically say, you know, these particular items that are relative, but I think that was implicit in what he was ordering. He understood this case. This case was before this judge for 2 years almost. He went through each of these informal discovery conferences with us. You know, he went in detail through this matter.
It's just troubling that in his findings after the trial, he doesn't say beneficiary, he says co-trustee. And I don't think that a reviewing court can go back and just amend those findings.
Yeah, Your Honor, the best answer I have for that is, you know, implicit in it was his acknowledgement of the beneficiary status.
But not that he seemed to say that beneficiaries and co-trustees are entitled to the same duties and information.
I think in the end, in whole, his opinion was that in good faith, the trust has been administered and there was no self-dealing. I believe my time is up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Judge Riley, I can answer your question. There was never, no warning was ever given about sanctions ever from the judge. I will say just, it's not in the record. We had these informal discovery conferences and the request for attorney's fees came up because I was asking for fees saying, Judge, we shouldn't have to keep doing this. They've told us they will not give us any documents unless you order them to do it. That's not right. That's not fair. You should make them pay our fees. And he said, well, we'll see what they produce as who, you know, whether you can get your fees or not. That was the only discussion, nothing about sanctions. This issue too.
And also
about,
not in the record.
Also not in the record. So, but nothing in the record. No warning to Peter or me or anyone else about sanctions ever. Now there was testimony at trial, Judge Bradfold, about these expenses and what the respondents' answers were to our concerns. You can read the trial transcript at page 108, cited in our brief. Sean Karakash admitted that the funds were commingled, the trust assets were commingled with personal assets, and that they used personal assets. They use trust assets for personal expenses. She admitted that on the record. There's a dozen other examples too that we made. A bicycle for the son, hockey skates for the son, cell phones for the son who supposedly worked at the resort. There's a dozen examples, Judge. Judge Bradfield, you had asked about case law in Minnesota suggesting that a Facebook friendship is a basis for disqualification. There isn't any. There's, I don't know that there's any anywhere in the country. But it's not just the Facebook friendship and that is the concern, Judge. The Minnesota Code of Judicial Conduct, Rule 2.11, Comment 5. A judge should disclose on the record information that the parties or their lawyers might reasonably consider relevant to a possible motion for disqualification. Disqualification is required in cases of an appearance of impropriety. There doesn't have to be an impropriety. There doesn't have to be some showing that the judge is completely conflicted because of a relationship. It's the appearance of one, Judge. Okay. When you get a ruling like this from the court, when you get this sanction order out of nowhere.
Well, I need to break your argument down a little bit. So you're saying it's the totality of everything that happened in district court? Because I read your argument as emphasizing the Facebook relationship, perhaps because there's something more behind it, but primarily that it has an appearance of impropriety, and I'm just not convinced of that based on the case law. As we all are well aware of, you know, there's numerous ways in which people are connected on social media.
Sure.
LinkedIn is another one, and if I were to be deemed to have to disclose every one of my LinkedIn connections prior to hearing every single case, I mean, that, for all I know, you and I are connected. I'm just asking you, what is your argument as to the appearance of impropriety?
Right. I think we are linked on LinkedIn. LinkedIn's not Facebook.
Here we go. So
LinkedIn
is up today.
LinkedIn is a professional is a network for professionals to talk about their jobs. Period. Facebook is not that. Facebook is for friends, and it's not just that Judge Podney was friends with Ms. Kloon, it's that his wife is friends with her too. And what I'm saying is. What happened? I don't know, Judge. That's the problem. I don't know if I would have thought there was impropriety at the beginning. If Judge Potney had said, I want everybody to know my wife and I are friends with Kelly Kloon, the defendant's lawyer here. We're friends on Facebook. I just want you guys to know if that's the case. So I said, thank you for disclosing that, Your Honor. I'll talk to my client and get back to you. I might have had some other questions for him about the nature and extent of the relationship, but I never got that chance because it never was disclosed. What happens is we get this court's order, and the first question when I talk about this with a colleague who tried the case and other people is, well, they must be friends. You must be there in that small town. They must be friends with each other. I'm like, I don't know. The associate comes back and says, look, friends on Facebook. So now it's like, I can't explain the judge's court, the judge's ruling and his findings of fact and conclusions of law that don't match the evidence in the case. The sanctions order that is just completely, I think,
so
I've never
Pastor,
seen anything like
it. I appreciate your frustration and the time and energy that's gone into this and the difficulty of the case, but you have not convinced me that it's all attributable to the judge's bias.
And
rather, it sounds to me as though you've made a pretty persuasive argument about legal error, that the judge went down the wrong path legally, and that is why you're entitled to some new findings of fact or a new trial. Well, we're still talking about that. But.
Yeah. He may, and you know what, Judge? He may not be biased at all. He might not be.
No, I understand. We're talking about appearance of.
Yeah, and all I'm saying is I just wanted the chance to know at the beginning. My client had a right to know at the beginning of the case, and we didn't get that. You don't know the appearance of impropriety. You can't tell unless a judge tells you. We didn't get told until we got this ruling. And it's like, how can this possibly be explained?
And I, as I said, I certainly appreciate that your argument isn't about actual bias.
And that's what I just
don't need to apply that. And
yeah,
I do appreciate the briefing
these
issues.
I just think direct back to that comment. It's just, we just wanted to disclose on the record so we could have made an informed decision or asked follow-up questions and never happened.
Any other questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it. Thanks to both lawyers. This case is well-briefed, well-argued. We very much appreciate the difficulty that is brought for the lawyers as well as the families involved. It's now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.